Welcome to the Connected MB podcast. I am your host, Joel Templeman. On this episode, I will be joined by my co-host, Dr. Wayne Kelly, and you will hear our conversation with representatives of the Internet Society and the Canadian Internet Registration Authority, where we look at some of the organizations around Canada and the world that support access to the Internet. Let's jump into our conversation with Natalie Campbell, Senior Director, North American Government and Regulatory Affairs for the Internet Society.
What do you see kind of across Canada, around the world, as, you know, where are we at from that 2019 kind of timeframe? Have we progressed? Are things going in the right direction? Are we falling farther behind? What very kind of generally speaking, what is the kind of state of connectivity? It's kind of a big question, but where do you see the last kind of like 5 years or so has gotten us? Are we on the right track?
Oh, that's a really good question. So from a global perspective, one of the things that we saw at the Internet Society when COVID broke out was, you know, everyone, like we've been, you know, shouting the connectivity internet for all line for a very long time. It's a big part of the Internet Society's existence. But when COVID happened, everybody else started recognizing the importance of that mission. And so it was super helpful in terms, you know, COVID was terrible and it affected many people, but the recognition that came from about the importance of the internet and how the internet allowed much of the world who is privileged enough to have access, affordable and fast and reliable access, it allowed us to do things like keep working, keep, you know, having doctor's appointments, keep doing school online, but it also highlighted the gaps in this availability. And so for us at the Internet Society, it was a really good kind of platform to say, hey, look, we all recognize how important, like, no, probably never more than ever than right now during COVID, it's not acceptable to have a situation where the internet is not for all, whether that's in terms of the availability of the internet to begin with, or whether it's other barriers to access like affordability or reliability, et cetera. So one of the solutions that the Internet Society has always kind of promoted as a way to support more digital equities, community networks. And what we saw increasingly in the last decade, but especially since COVID, is more recognition throughout governments around the world that community networks are a viable solution. We know there's proven success that these are ways to bring fast, affordable, reliable internet in ways that communities are in a driver's seat, and they can develop these solutions in ways that meet the community needs. It's very important that governments are recognizing this, because then they can start to enable more of these solutions to come to life, whether that's in developing policies that make, you know, developing community networks more easy, whether it's in terms of spectrum access or even funding for these kinds of solutions. These are all important steps towards enabling more community networks to come to life. But I would say that I think since COVID, though, there's been a lot of government recognition on the importance of community networks, when it comes to internet access, there's been, I think, a lot of, especially in the US and Canada, it's largely been about infrastructure, right? Does the infrastructure exist? Is there an option? And while that's great, it's really important to focus on infrastructure. Those are not the only barriers to internet access. And I mean, in the US, we saw a lot of money in things like the BEAD program go towards enabling communities, and especially in Indigenous communities, to build out infrastructure solutions. There's a lot of gaps in what that funding can actually enable. It's one thing to like build the infrastructure, but there's definitely a need for a more holistic approach to make sure that people are actually getting access to fast, affordable, and reliable internet. In Canada, we're kind of in a similar situation, right? I mean, I think we're probably a little bit behind in terms of funding, because the BEAD funding was really important towards supporting those infrastructure projects. In Canada, we have, you know, the Universal Service Fund and the CRTC Broadband Fund, again, really focus on infrastructure. But when it comes to access to the internet, it's not just about making sure the infrastructure is available. It's whether, you know, people can actually have access. Is it affordable? And I think probably the most important piece of recognition of this that I saw in Canada was in 2023 when the Auditor General released a report saying, listen, it's, you know, if we're not tracking affordability when we're talking about access to the internet, we're not getting an accurate picture. We're not getting any closer to our target goals if we aren't tracking who actually has access to the internet as opposed to whether an option exists or not. So I think to me, that's probably it's a really high level, quick overview of where I see things are at. But it's great. There's been a lot more focus on supporting infrastructure and supporting community-driven initiatives. There's still a lot to be done to make sure that the funding is there and not just in a, you know, let's help the infrastructure exist, but do it in a way that communities can drive the solutions and not just think, you know, what else is needed in terms of connectivity. But I think we have a long ways to go in terms of understanding what internet affordability looks like in Canada and how much that is actually a barrier to access. And it's going to be important to continue doing so.
Thanks so much, Natalie. I just want to go back to a bit of the conversation around the community networks. Can you talk a bit more about where community networks fit or work best in terms of, you know, where do you see them being a good solution for connecting rural and sort of northern communities?
I think the thing that's great about community networks is that they can bring fast, affordable, reliable internet solutions to places that have very particular challenge when it comes to connectivity. We know that, you know, in some places, there's not the economic incentive for incumbents to come and deliver solutions that might be the fastest or highest speed or the most affordable, as, you know, in places where there are economies of scale. And so what community networks type solutions allow is for communities to get together and think of, well, how can we address this need in a way that isn't just relying on the incumbent to come and provide an option or a solution? We've seen this work in a lot of settings, and the Internet Society has partnered on some of these solutions in North America. So I can give one example where we have, I mean, there's a bunch of examples where we've been supportive, but a particular challenge in terms of connectivity that we saw was in the Arctic community of Uluhaktuk, which we first approached in talking to in 2019. At the time, they're very limited in terms of access options. It was super expensive. There were data caps. It was ridiculous how expensive this community is paying for the internet, and especially for what they're actually getting in terms of internet access. So when we approached the community and started talking about what potential solutions might be, you know, we know that fiber, at least at the moment, is not an option, right? There's a lot of geographical challenges when you think about the vastness of the Northwest Territories and the actual terrain of the Northwest Territories. Fiber is probably not an option right now, and it definitely wasn't an option in the near future. But at the same time, community networks can consider all kinds of different options for backhaul. So we had, you know, worked with the community to kind of think about different types of backhaul solutions, and ultimately we settled on a very simple starting solution, which was we essentially used a Starlink terminal as backhaul, right? So this is one thing that we noticed, probably another trend that I could have mentioned before, but in the last few years, we've really seen expansion of low Earth orbit satellites and Starlink come into the market. And certainly, you know, from our conversations with Uluhaka in 2019 to when we returned in 2023, we noticed there was a lot of uptake of Starlink in the community. But at the same time, is that an affordable option? It's, you know, I think I saw a article recently that said probably a quarter of the community is in the low income threshold. And certainly that was very consistent for us in terms of when we did start to, you know, when we did launch our community network, which as I was saying before, we ultimately used a Starlink terminal as the backhaul, built a Wi-Fi network to be able to make it available throughout the community so that residents had a no-cost option to access the internet. Well, when we started looking at how many people are actually on the network, probably about a quarter of the community is using this network, which is super consistent with the last measure I saw about how many folks are in the low income threshold within the community. So what that tells me is that, you know, it's great to see advances like low Earth orbit satellite. It's, you know, might not be optimal in terms of the type of bandwidth that things like fiber can make available, but certainly it's an option that makes the internet faster and more reliable in some communities. But even then, is it affordable? And, you know, according to our research, like there's still definitely a need for more affordable options, which is what the community network that we worked on with the community Uluhakduk certainly helped deliver. And so I think that's just one example of, I think, the benefits of community networks, right? Like we had a really particular set of challenges that the community was dealing with, and they were able to at least find a starting solution that was relatively simple as a start point to make sure that anyone in the community, wherever you were, could have access to the internet. And especially, you know, it was kind of interesting because the same summer that the community network was deployed in Uluhakduk, the Northwest Territories had its worst forest fire season ever. And, you know, while a lot of homes in Uluhakduk had Starlink and our community network made, you know, Starlink backhaul type access available at no cost to the broader community once that network was deployed, there were entire communities in the southern parts of the Northwest Territories that had no internet access because either they didn't have a Starlink or parts of the fiber were actually, you know, harmed by the forest fires. And so they had no way of communicating, you know, emergency evacuation measures in some communities. And so it just highlights, like, to me, that it's great to have internet options available, but you can't just rely on one, right? The more the better. And even in situations where, you know, Starlink might have helped folks in Uluhakduk or even in those southern communities, right? Not everyone have access to it. And if everyone is relying on one kind of access, what happens when that's not available? There are pretty serious consequences. Anyways, I'm rambling now. I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, no, this is really helpful. And actually, I just wanted to build on that. You've talked about the importance of affordability and reliability in addition to just the infrastructure elements, right? Are there other factors that affect both the access and the use of the internet?
I think that in terms of barriers to access, if we're looking at Canada, definitely what we've seen in some rural northern Indigenous communities as a barrier is things like having not just the affordability, but also things like having government issued ID or having credit. Those can be significant barriers to getting internet access that are pretty significant hurdles, especially if you're in communities that don't have, you know, things like banks located within them, right? These can be, or even government service points, or, you know, where the internet access is not even to the level where you can use government services within a community. Those are pretty huge barriers. In terms of use of the internet, I think a lot of communities are pretty quick to learn how to use the internet, but definitely having internet access available and in an unlimited kind of way is important. But there's also the aspect of digital literacy that I think a lot more communities are starting to talk about, especially when looking at things like the broadband fund. Again, it's one thing to have infrastructure, but there's a lot other aspects that come to enabling access to the internet, especially in a safe and secure way, that need to be considered when promoting digital equity, because it's not enough to just have access to the internet and to have it in an affordable kind of way, but people really do need to know how to be able to use the internet in a way that is secure and safe to them. So I think that digital literacy is super important, but also digital security, especially as, you know, the internet threat landscape is continuously evolving. What internet use looks like today is continuously evolving. Things like AI completely change the game of what it means to, you know, use the internet in a safe and secure way, and what kind of threats to things like privacy exist now. That's constantly evolving. So I do believe that digital literacy, but plus with all of the security and safety aspects of it involved, is something that both should be considered when thinking about access to the internet, but also could be a barrier to some who are afraid of the internet, and very justifiably so. There's a lot of things to be worried about. And if you aren't equipped with the knowledge on how to use the internet in a way that is safe and secure to you and your community, that can be a real deterrent to internet use as well.
Well, and I think that's, you made the point earlier, it's a holistic view, right? I think of some communities who get, you know, great story, they get fiber optics, you know, they've got some big fire hose of internet, you know, maybe they even do like a fiber to the home project or something. So they've got all of the physical infrastructure you could possibly want, gold standard, but they just got dropped into that world, right? This isn't like the rest of us have kind of, who started with dial-up, we've kind of learned slowly over time and have adapted, and it's become part of our lives. But I think of the small communities where this is all of a sudden just boom in their laps. And like you said, especially from a security point of view, a use point of view, it's like learning to drive in a Ferrari, right? Like, it's like, here, we're going to go on the Autobahn in a Ferrari, and it's your first time driving. Like, it just seems a little insane, but it also just seems a little intimidating as well, right? So I think that's interesting, and something I'd want to kind of explore is, where are we at with that adoption side of it? Where are we at with it? So there's been a lot of talk about digital literacy, you know, over the last 10 years. It's been a thing in schools for a number of years. It never really stops. You always need more. But that seems to be kind of the next barrier or the next big thing. Are we progressing in that? Where do we need to do work in that on the user support side?
That's a good question. I look at it in a bunch of different ways, but mainly because one part of my job is looking at how laws are trying to address these issues. So earlier this year, the government introduced the Online Harms Act because it is trying to tackle things that are very horrible, maybe awful, but lawful online, and trying to find ways to discourage some of that, you know, in the hopes of making the internet safer and more secure. But even then, like, there has to be recognition that it's not just one entity that can make the internet safer, right? The government can certainly do things to incentivize more security online. Schools can definitely play a role in helping to make sure that people know how to be safe and secure in the online, but also to teach these skills in a controlled environment where there is some knowledge transfer that happens in ways that are actually super relevant to youth. But there are so many gaps in this. And so I think that we can't just look at one solution. It has to be in the schools. It has to be looked at from all different kinds of ways. Another thing that, you know, where I see in terms of policy that can help out is, again, when we're making things, when we're looking at funding, right, with the broadband fund or whatever it may be, making sure that those are inclusive to aspects of internet connectivity that are not just infrastructure, but that are digital literacy, that are digital security, that is a crucial way. Because especially when we're, you know, what I've heard, even my participation at places like the Indigenous Connectivity Summit, digital literacy in schools is great, but digital literacy in communities has to be delivered in ways that are culturally relevant to communities, in ways that are like understandable and really hyper relevant to communities. And the way to do that, one way we can do that, is to make sure that there's a funding available for these initiatives. There's not one course that is going to like be the be all end all to everyone, right? It's really important that people have self-determination in terms of how to make this information relevant and meaningful to those who need to know about how to use the internet in a way that is going to benefit them, but also keep them safe and secure as well. And how that is delivered looks different to every single community. So yeah, I do think it's holistic, right? And there's not just one solution, but it's something that needs to be looked at from different aspects.
I think you touched on a good point, and a group that gets forgotten a lot of the times, and I forget them all the time as well. Librarians, or the libraries. Shout out to all the librarians that do amazing work, program, have great programs, need more funding, need more staff, right? Need those things, and because they're locally in those communities, like you say, it needs to be adaptable to the conditions of the wants and needs. Not everybody wants to use the internet the same way or has the same need to do it. So supporting those local initiatives helps to focus on that. Like you said, you can't know everything about everything, so you've got to be able to focus it. So no, that's a great perspective.
Yeah, I also think there's something to be said about finding ways to incentivize parents to learn about safety and security online. I know myself, I have a 10-year-old and a 12-year-old who are very much interested in using the internet and are lucky that they have a parent who works at the internet study and does a lot of thinking about ways to be safe and secure online and how to promote internet use and to teach them the skills that they need to be able to, be able to use the internet in their learning and development and exploration of themselves, but while avoiding some of the risks. And even as a mom who works at the internet study, that is not an easy task to do. And I see a lot of other parents, here's the iPad, here's access to the internet, and they're not as involved. And I can certainly understand why that happens, right? Especially if you aren't aware of the risk to the degree that, I spend my day job looking into a lot of the risks online. But that also terrifies me. And I think that thinking about ways to incentivize parents to be more informed about some of the risks and to be able to, help encourage them to, transfer some of that knowledge to their kids in ways that, help them navigate the internet and learn and embed in their lives in ways that are appropriate to their families. I think there's a lot that can be done there and should be done there, frankly.
I saw a webinar recently talking about this specifically. It was a bunch of parents and a bunch of teenage kids, I guess, that were in the audience. And the general claim was that this generation tends to overprotect in real life and underprotect in cyber life. Like you said, it's, kids nowadays are going out, to go ride their bike in the neighborhood unattended for an hour much later, right? When we used to do it when we're 5 or 6, the new, generations now, they're going to be teenagers or whatever before they do that. But at the same time, it's like you said, here's an iPad, go hang out for a little while, right? Like just unrestricted access to everything in the world, right? So I think that's something we need to kind of look at the frameworks of and balance those frames works with, real research. Where is it unsafe and what is unsafe? And because it doesn't necessarily look like that, I don't think. So being able to support parents, because like you said, parents don't necessarily know busy things that we need to be able to get those kind of resources and support and recommendations out as well, so that we can at least make determinations about what we will and won't be more protective about. I think those are all great points.
Absolutely.
So as we're looking at communities that have been sort of, historically underserved, one of the things we're hearing is that there's an actual capacity element around understanding all of this themselves, right? Are there supports out there for communities, not to build their digital literacy of their residents, but the communities, whether it's champions in communities or organizations, to build their digital literacy around, how to get connected, around why digital safety is so important and why it's an evolving issue, and around why this stuff might need to be tailored to their specific rural, remote, or northern context?
I think there's a bunch of different resources available. The Internet Society has several resources on you know, how to determine whether your community is ready for a community network and how to develop a community network and what are some of the ways that you can finance a community network. We have some of those generic type resources and certainly a bunch of training courses that could help complement that. We have a bunch of grant programs as well that, excuse me, that can help support some of those initiatives. But I think that one of the best things that any community can do when thinking about, you know, how, whether developing a community-driven network is something they might want to do is to get involved with the Indigenous Connectivity Summit community. And this is an event that, you know, the Internet Society had initially started back in 2017, feels like a long time ago, but that now is housed with the Indigenous Connectivity Institute, which basically is created out of the ICS community itself, which became so strong that they spun out of the Internet Society and are now the Institute and are now home to the Indigenous Connectivity Summit. But what this is a huge community of network operators, connectivity experts, community leaders, anyone who has a shared goal of supporting fast, affordable, reliable access in Indigenous communities. Anyone you want to know of is involved with this community. And it's a great start point to kind of understand, well, how might I be able to think about or even start a solution like this in my community and connect with people who can help make that happen? Because the internet really is, I like to think about the internet being, you know, the internet is basically built out of handshakes, right? It's a lot of partnerships. There's a lot of people working together to create solutions to sometimes really hard, complex problems. And the ICS community has produced a lot of magic over the years and been a great resource for folks. I know that the Indigenous Connectivity Institute as well has a bunch of programs that can help train communities. There's a tribal broadband boot camp that often partners with ICI. We funded them as well. That's very on the ground, tailored and customized training to communities that has been really successful.
You have a unique perspective with the job that you do, kind of worldwide. So if we zoom all the way out, you know, we're working away, you know, focused on, in this particular podcast, focused on Manitoba and support to communities that are here and highlighting different communities that have done projects like this. Are there places around the world that are doing it right? Places that we should be looking at?
But one example I can think of, though, in terms of one specific policy recommendation that we've been supporting is the notion of Indigenous spectrum access. It's something that in Canada, the government is starting to look at now and how to make sure that spectrum licenses are more accessible to Indigenous communities. And that's a huge development for Canada. Probably also another trend I should have mentioned, because spectrum sovereignty is something that really, I think, the Maori are really leading on in terms of, you know, this notion of Indigenous rights to spectrum and how do we make sure that, you know, those licenses, like even just the managing of spectrum to begin with and who gets access to these licenses and who gets the profits from like awarding these licenses. The Maori are really leading all over on all angles of this issue and have influenced policy changes in the US, where a few years ago there was a short Indigenous priority window to certain bands of spectrum. And since then, now Canada is looking at redoing its entire spectrum policy to look at how we can make spectrum more accessible to Indigenous communities. And it's something that's in the works now. And that's just one example of perhaps a country to look at that is doing something right, but that's very spectrum fococused.
Excellent. Just a 2-second primer, and correct me if I'm wrong, but so spectrum, we're talking about the electromagnetic spectrum being a natural resource. And the important part is that that is where all wireless communication, it needs the electromagnetic spectrum to communicate all on different frequencies. And it's regulated because if I was broadcasting on a frequency and you were trying to broadcast on the frequency, we would crash into each other and that's a problem. So it's all divided up by the government. The government, because it needs to be managed in some way, takes that control and has decided to license out different spectrums. So different frequencies are licensed to different groups. But they do that at a price. They do that at a profit. And it's for people who aren't in that area, the dollar values are huge, right? When this isn't thousands of dollars, this is millions of dollars. So this is a huge thing. And I think the importance of it too is that from the Indigenous point of view, they have resource rights. So the electromagnetic spectrum is a natural resource. So that is part of the argument, I think, that they're being excluded from that, those rights. But also especially in a rural context, wireless is a huge factor as far as getting a signal distributed around because of the small populations and because of the terrain and northern Manitoba and the Arctic, but it's a tough place to, like you said, put fiber in the ground. So wireless is a great option, but the way that it is managed needs, and like you said, luckily Canada is exploring a revision on how it's all managed and who is benefiting from it and where that money goes and all that. So that entire discussion is very, I mean, there's an episode all just in spectrum alone, but I don't know. Is that a good recap of the spectrum argument?
That's an excellent recap, Joel. Thank you.
It's something that a lot of people are involved in necessarily, but it's a huge factor. And you know, like you said, New Zealand, Australia, hopefully we could add Canada to that list of leading the way in new and better ways to utilize that resource for the public good, as opposed to necessarily making money off of it. So it's definitely a conversation to follow. Excellent. Thank you.
This has been fantastic, Natalie. Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Connected MB, a podcast exploring rural connectivity in Manitoba. Before we jump to our next conversation, a quick reminder, you can find links to today's research, reports, and community initiatives on our project website at connectedmb.ca. Now let's continue our conversation.
I'm Maureen James, Community Investment Program Manager at CIRA, and I've been working with CIRA for 6 years, running, among other things, our annual grants program. And so that's given me a perspective on some of the digital needs across the country. Our grants program is meant to give back to Canada's internet. CIRA itself is the manager of Canada's top-level domain, .ca. So we generate revenue through that and through cybersecurity products and services. As a nonprofit organization, we take some of the surplus and give it back to Canada's internet through things like our grants program and the internet performance tests, which Jeff will be telling you about a bit more. So that gives us a perspective. We set the priorities in our give back program through three different pillars: infrastructure, which is the connectivity area, online safety, and policy engagement. And in particular, I think the connectivity and policy engagement areas often intersect in rural, sort of the needs that we see, the gaps and the needs that we see in rural areas. Our granting program originally didn't necessarily focus on community-led initiatives, but has transitioned to that as a really strong focus, because we want not only for communities that are lacking internet connectivity to get that connectivity, but also to own and be able to be in charge of developing that connectivity as a community development kind of initiative, as opposed to relying on third parties, because that seems to be the people that most need the kinds of grants that we offer. So we have over $1 million that we fund out, disperse out in grants each year. And a proportion of those goes to connectivity in rural, northern, and indigenous areas across the country. And the projects that we're seeing are ones where communities want to build their own infrastructure and be responsible for that, and often generate revenue from that they can continue to just kind of build their own capacity to deliver service. So those are the kinds of examples we've been seeing in all sorts of different places across the country. So we can talk about that a bit more in depth, but I think the community-led focus has been a really important way for us to look at this kind of need and the demand and building longer-term independence in communities.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. Jeff. Please go ahead.
Hi, so I'm Jeff Buell. I'm the Internet Performance Test Program Manager at CIRA. So Maureen and the Grants Program and NetGood and IPT work alongside each other quite a bit. And one of the big, so the Internet Performance Test takes data from Canadian Internet users. So a person would initiate a test, run a test, and then we capture that anonymized data in a database and then make it available to communities or researchers or anyone that's looking to try and improve access, particularly in rural and remote areas. So what I see as one main challenge or one main problem is like access to data and trying to understand the magnitude of the connectivity gap in a lot of communities. I think there's a lot of anecdotal awareness that communities may be underserved, but there's not a lot of proof or evidence to support that. And so the IPT is an important tool to identify that. And the difference being that a lot of the data that's available would come from the provider, from the internet service provider, or from the government programs, whereas the data from the internet performance test comes from the consumer. So we like to look at it as kind of a ground proof or a checkpoint of availability in those areas that are underserved.
Yeah, excellent. When we're talking to communities, they're usually at a point when they get this far that they have identified the problem, often without good data. Like you said, they just know from their experience that they have lack of access, or their bills are too high, or, you know, there's little to nothing in the community. So I think the other big piece is that is not just a fact, but that fact has gone on long enough that they have been motivated to take this on themselves, right? The big factor here is, you know, lots of communities have this problem and share these concerns, but they're at a point where I guess they've realized, you know, the cavalry is not coming over the hill, or that, you know, they're not going to get this problem taken care of. It's been a problem for a long time, and it doesn't look like something's necessarily changed. They may have had promises in the past of change from any number of levels, from ISPs or government or, you know, small community groups or whatever, but they've realized that they need to take, you know, action into their own hands to do that. And then we have heard from community as well that data, access to data, to put together proposals and even to have a benchmark, even to have the, you know, knowing we have to show that we succeeded in some way, they kind of have to have some kind of a mark where are we at today. And the other one is funding, right? There's a number of factors, but those two come up pretty consistently. So do you have any examples or any general kind of themes that you see from a number of projects? I appreciate that all these projects are extremely different and they're tailored to their communities, but, you know, just kind of thinking generally, what do you see as patterns, and maybe has there anything been in the last couple of years that are different? Often we hear that the pandemic was a big shifting point. So maybe from that 2019 forward, you know, what are you seeing in the last, you know, 5 years or so?
Yeah, don't mind, just I'll jump in. So yeah, for sure, COVID, I think, was a big transition point for, there's a lot of people that worked in the field of rural internet that understood the problem and understood it for a long time. But then it seemed like the rest of the country woke up to challenges in digital equity and digital access during COVID, when people were forced to work and do their learning from home. So I think, you know, on the positive side, that I do think the government response was fairly good, was fairly positive. I think from the federal government, the Universal Broadband Fund, with the rapid response stream, they were pretty quick in instituting that. And so those were for the shovel ready projects that were ready to get off the ground. And they moved fairly quickly. And I think they only had a year to get those done. And so from what I saw, there was quite a bit of success there. I know the subsequent projects, probably the larger build projects that were more regional, more complicated networks, I know that they are still in flight. So I've been working in the industry for long enough where, you know, certainly government funding leads to success for a lot of projects. But for a period of time, what sometimes happens is it creates a real pause in activity that in projects that were just going to be privately funded. So there's a lot, you know, if there's rumor or otherwise that a project's been funded in an area, that tends to stop private investment in activity from others, particularly smaller providers are unwilling to grow their network just in case another provider was funded in that area. So that, like, the good and the bad, like, I think government funding is necessary and it's brought us a long way, but sometimes it creates these unintended consequences of, you know, there's a pause in builds. And then if something goes wrong with the project or doesn't move forward, the funded project, I mean, then that leads to, you know, the greater problem of the issue wasn't addressed in a community.
Okay, excellent. Thank you.
I think I could add a little bit from the perspective that I hear talking to grant applicants and recipients. I think what Jeff says is right. I think there's been a huge response from government, and it's the really small communities that have a hard time accessing that funding. They aren't necessarily established as organizations that can prove a track record of being able to deliver massive, you know, installation projects. And so they're often at a disadvantage to get access to money, and or if they are in there, if they have proposals in, it can, the timeline on them can be so long. So often a lot of communities end up saying, okay, let's figure out what we can do ourselves while we're waiting to hear, or just do it a different way, you know, come up with a different solution. So I think there are probably a number of kinds of solutions that we funded, which wouldn't necessarily be the gold standard of what a community might need in the long term, but they're kind of putting things together that will at least help them have connectivity at all. And so I think that's interesting. I think the other thing that we've heard from many of our recipients is that because we're not government, and when we do fund these projects, it's not a huge amount of money. Our grants don't go above $100,000, but that allows certain types of installations to happen. It allows certain types of connectivity to happen. And we are pretty light on reporting requirements and that kind of thing. So the people can put in an application in April and here by July and be, you know, shovels in the ground right away, or whatever it is that they need to mobilize to make their projects happen. And reporting is really straightforward, and there's no holdback of funds or having to prove stuff. It's kind of a pretty simple process once organizations are able to, you know, present an application that is deemed viable.
Yeah, like, just to support what Maureen's saying, like, I think both from a community as well as a small regional ISP, very difficult to access funding just from the application perspective, even simply just for resources. Like, a lot of, from a community perspective, a lot of these people have more than full-time jobs. Like, these are municipalities or First Nations that people are doing two or three roles. They don't have time to not only write the application for funding, but to shepherd it through the various stages of the process. And then what do they do with it once they receive it too? And that goes the same with small local ISPs. They're in the same situation, under-resourced, very difficult for them to approach the funding process, especially feeling that they're unlikely to be successful just based on their perception and the track record.
Okay. I mean, I think it's a good point, a good place to pause and give a shout out to both of your efforts. We will share in the show notes and in the things that we push out, we'll share the information about the funding opportunities and about the performance test. Both to those listening, please, you know, utilize them and seek them out. I know that there's been lots of effort to even get the word out. I know that there's been workshops that we've, you know, put on. You've kind of done the roadshow around Canada, trying to get people to get the word out, because, like you said, these are small communities, and the number of people working on these things are often double and triple hatted in their roles. So we'll continue to help push the word out, but please try to access them. And as far as the data goes, more and the more users using it, both for their just day-to-day activities, if you're going to check your speed in a speed test, then using this version would help everybody, right? So data from across Canada, even if it's not in your specific location, is helpful. The more the more data points we get in the database, the better we have, and keeping it up to date. So using it regularly, it's free and easy, and everybody benefits from it. Wayne, you're going to say?
Yeah, I just know it's great. I just wanted to follow up on those comments and sort of this discussion. And so, Maureen, when you're saying in terms of the communities that are applying to the infrastructure grant, are those the small communities that are not able to apply for the UBF typically then?
Typically, yes. Some of them have had UBF applications in queue for multiple years. I haven't heard. And so they are finding ways to at least get pieces done in the meantime. But in most cases, they are pretty small communities that haven't gone the UBF route yet. But we've also, our funding has also been used for match funding too, for UBF projects. So there's different ways, and we're open to all sorts of possibilities where our resources can be used to help bring that connectivity on. But I do think, as someone who's been kind of keeping an eye on the overall picture of our grants program over the last 6 years, the requests for connectivity projects certainly went up once COVID hit. And they haven't actually stayed up that much. Like it's, I think anywhere between, well, probably around 20% of our projects average would be connectivity projects, but mostly in the last few years, and a lot in British Columbia in particular. So there's some really great examples there of interesting ways that people have worked together to solve problems. And I think one of the things we always do, a post-project reflection with the groups that we funded to hear. So yeah, you submitted your report, but tell us what really happened, like bring it to life for us, right? This is words on a page, and we want to hear from your community. And one of the ones we spoke to recently, I think it really hit home the value of a community-led network, which is the fact that they are able to, they know the people, they know the few hundreds of people maybe that they're serving in a community, and they understand who can afford what and how they can tailor their pricing, because they do sell internet services in many cases. They want to get people on a plan, but they know, you know, who has which access, who's way over there and who's way over here, and that kind of thing. And so when there's any problems, they're on the ground right away, able to do something. Whereas so many other initiatives we've heard of that are relying on the major players don't get any service necessarily right away in that kind of way. So targeted plans and immediate service. And then I guess the other thing that we've been hearing so much about, particularly in BC, is how important it is for community resiliency in the case of whether it's floods or fires or whatever's going on. Having that kind of connectivity for emergency communication is essential. And so many communities that are very small are still without it. And I think it's a very small percentage that, you know, the major government funding isn't reaching, but it still makes a difference in those places.
No, that's really helpful. And can you just sort of expand a bit on that? And then Jeff, I have a question about the data collection too. But Maureen, can you just expand a bit on, you know, what support do those really small communities that you're talking about need to even apply for funding? You've both described some of the capacity issues, but like, you know, what supports do they need to be able to address their connectivity locally?
Well, I'll start, and I'm sure Jeff would have some lived experience himself from different initiatives he's been involved in. But I think for any supplier of funding to consider a community, they have to show a track record of having run certain kinds of projects, having financials, project management. There's a team that they're instilling in the provider the confidence that this is going to go ahead. And so it's kind of pulling all of that stuff together and a plan, you know, what's the timeline for the project, what's delivery. And I think the thing that we've found with ours is that they're small and we have to be super flexible, because for example, we just got a report in a couple of weeks ago from Northwest Territories, who basically had to put their whole project on hold because they were evacuated from their community last summer and could only start this summer. And so we just kind of go, yep, got it. We'll just extend it for a year kind of thing. So I think they really appreciate the ability to just have those kind of conversations with us. And sometimes that's not as easy in other situations, but I do think the kinds of reporting that federal and provincial government may require are leaps and bounds and, you know, deeper than I think what we require. We can certainly audit any project, and we always promise to in our contracts if we felt the need, but we trust that the on the way in, we've done sufficient review of what we can find out about the community. And we have a large evaluation panel that looks at the projects before we would even go ahead with them. So we try to take care of it on the way in and keep an eye on it while it's going on.
Usually it's resource-based and just the ability to respond and again, to shepherd it through the process. And then the other thing too, is a lot of small communities maybe don't have a great positive relationship with, you know, service providers as well. Sometimes they're antagonistic because there's been such a push for so many years and trying to advocate in it to improve service that just because of that, sometimes those relationships are strained and they're not easy to form a partnership.
And then following up on that, Jeff, like for those small communities that are applying, are those communities going back to the data collection on the ground? Are those communities also underrepresented in the data, or are they filling out the data for the, you know, for the ground proofing? And
right. I think the biggest issue with the data is really the accuracy. So I think right now the data that's most often used comes from the internet service providers coverage mapping that's submitted to the CRTC and the federal government. And that is overlaid with different census population data. And then because of privacy matters, that information is usually presented publicly in different ways that really generalizes it and makes it less granular. So it is certainly getting better. But in the past, I think you both remember the big hexagon days where within 25 square kilometers, if a couple of households were served, that kind of identified that whole hexagon or that whole area as being ineligible for funding. Federal government, through their mapping, has really come a long way and now is mapping it to road segments and what they call pseudo households, which is derivative of the census subdivision. So it's better, but it is still largely an estimate of services. So that's the data that's being accessed, and that's the data that's basing eligibility on, and that's the data that's being identified in the application process. So we know, like in the past, broadband service gaps were so huge that it didn't matter. The granularity of the data didn't matter. Now it's quite precise. Well, I shouldn't say precise, but these little pockets or islands of areas that aren't connected. And that can be in areas that are nearby major urban centers, these little suburbs or rural areas. It's not the whole community, but it's a few addresses here and there. And so that's why we need precise instruments to identify those gaps. So not only to be able to quantify who needs service, but also to spend the money wisely. You know, the government or other funding agencies don't want to provide funding to overbuild a network. They just want to identify the areas and fund and build appropriately.
And do those small underserved communities or those underserved regions still are sort of fighting for connectivity that, you know, do they have the capacity to navigate that data and to use that data in their applications?
Yeah, I think you'd be surprised. So I think the people that understand that have really come a long way in educating themselves in the data that's needed. So I would say yes, that they do a pretty good job of navigating that process from a data perspective.
I guess it's one thing to make clear, and again, correct me if I'm wrong or add to it, but what we have had in the past and what we still basically do is a availability equals connectivity kind right. of idea, where if there is stuff in the ground that in the area that you're in, then check that is, you know, so I think it's important to highlight because, you know, every once in a while the government comes out with 99% of all Canadians are connected. Yep. And things like that. There are numbers in this game are definitely important and nuanced, I guess, if I was going to be nice about it, difficult to really kind of drill down into, but it doesn't necessarily mean that people in that area are actually able to afford that connection or have the devices to utilize it. I know Sierra does a lot of work in cybersecurity, providing different tools for users, but using things safely is still a concern, right? So we're still talking, when we're talking about deployment and connectivity, we're talking about it being the infrastructure being in that area, which again, like you said, you know, for those of us who've been doing this for a while, that has changed quite a bit. You know, that used to be when we were talking gaps, they were massive gaps, regional gaps. So, you know, this is a good story, but a not done story, I think, right? This is, there has been progress, and it's efforts like yours, programs like these that have been chipping away at that huge problem, I think. So I think that's important just as a waypoint check-in, maybe, I guess, is that, you know, don't believe everything you read. It's not necessarily 1% off fixed 100% yet, but there has been progress. And it's these conversations and these projects, I think, that are being seen and recognized by the government and by agencies like yourselves that do funding to really look at those barriers and work around them. Like Maureen, like you're saying, you know, I know your program goes out of its way literally to, you know, get the word out there for people to apply and then work, you know, case by case. I'm sure it's extra effort on your team's part to do that, because it's not just a one size fits all kind of a thing, right? You're adapting as they're adapting, which really helps with that barrier. So I think that's an important point to highlight as we go forward, that we need more of that kind of an approach, I think.
And on the topic of more of that, one of the things we always feel stymied by is there are always way more projects that are seeking funding than we're able to fund with what we have. So, you know, it's $1.25 million a year, and we could do so much more if there were more for these kinds of small projects. So we often think about who else might want to just put into this pool so that Sierra could do more, you know? So it's worth thinking about ways that what we do, we know it gets match funded quite frequently, but just making sure that word gets out too, as we're doing this, how can you add on, not you guys in particular, but you out there in the world, people with resources that want to see this connectivity piece done. And I wanted to pick up on another point that you made, Joel, around just because it's there doesn't mean people can actually access it. And you're looking at rural, but that is one of the projects that we're doing right here in Ottawa, where you think, oh, well, everybody must have connectivity, but people who cannot afford the plans do not have connectivity. And so we're working with one of the local nonprofit organizations here, National Capital Freenet, to do an in-city community Wi-Fi project that we're piloting to just see how we may be able to address some of that digital gap, which is really an affordability gap. And I'm sure that that isn't just in urban areas, but we certainly see it here. And people make assumptions about everybody having access because you look at the availability map and you go, wow, well, that's taken care of. And, you know, a place like Ottawa, you think it would be, but every major urban center has these kinds of gaps. So there's still work to do and ways to creatively solve these problems often with community organizations that are directly involved.
So following up on that, Maureen and Jeff, you're talking about like the grants have not actually kept climbing for those small and underserved communities. Where do you see it going are we getting the rest of them connected, or have we, you know, maxed out the capacity of another tier and that there is another tier below them that need more or different supports? What are your insights into sort of connecting the rest of those communities?
Right. Yeah. So it's connecting the rest, I think, is the important point, because I think we have definitely the government funding and the funding from organizations like Sierra have gotten to this point. And, you know, whatever we're at, like, I think we're around 99% of the entire country can access 50 by 10 services. But it's like, when you drill down, you look at Indigenous communities, or when you look at rural communities, or when you look at the far north, you know, those are where the real challenges are. And so it's getting that last remaining percent that is going to definitely take probably some innovation and some different thinking. Like, I think the focus for now certainly has been on fiber, expanding fiber out to as many households or as many communities as possible. But to go beyond, you know, where we're at soon, we're probably going to have to look at some alternative technologies that will serve that farthest last mile, and making sure that those technologies aren't just good enough for today, but they're also future-proof, as close to as future-proof as fiber is. Certainly, LEO has made a huge improvement and has been a big benefit for many people. But the verdict's still out if that's going to be able to address future needs. And internet connectivity is one part, but it's also all the other advanced things that internet connectivity brings, like access, education, and health resources and things like that, which, you know, also need to be addressed.
I don't think we will stop seeing requests for connectivity funding. I think they take a lot of different forms, and often it'll be something as simple as, we are a small community and we need to have our central community centers and libraries and such and such more available to people than they currently are, or we want to run a hotspot lending program, or et cetera. Like that, so it can take different forms. I would say full on community access is still something that we'll be seeing applications for the next few years, I'd say, especially from First Nations communities, Indigenous communities, realizing that we are a source for that. And sometimes, again, the word doesn't get out that easily. So that's something we continue to work on. But yeah, there were certainly ones that we weren't able to fund this year just because we didn't have sufficient funds, and they are competing against other topic areas too. So that's a reality that we deal with every year.
Where are we at, maybe from your point of view? What do you see from these communities across the country? Where are we at from the adoption side?
I'm happy to jump in on that one briefly. Again, from the perspective of our grants program, I would say we've seen a huge surge in people concerned about online safety across the country, small communities, large communities, big urban centers. It can be focused on particular community interests or populations, like seniors or LGBTQ+, or, you know, it's financial literacy, students understanding healthy relationships online, those kinds of things. So there's a huge range of now that you have access, there's so much out there to be aware of. I think, unfortunately, the emphasis is often put on be wary of, like, it's a scary place. But the whole point of trying to make using the internet positive experience has been really important to us through some of the projects that we fund through our online safety category. So that saw a huge surge in the last year or two, partly because we also have a focus on students. So that's rural, Northern, Indigenous, and students. And I think there's been huge concerns, for example, about sextortion and the kinds of things that can happen to you online, and the consequences of not knowing how to handle those kind of situations. So I think there's a really big buildup of that kind of content being developed in different communities, which is important to see. And then I think, of course, CIRA itself has its own cybersecurity awareness training platform, which we use with different municipalities, schools, hospitals, et cetera. So I think that aspect of helping people understand and know the basics of, and keep refreshing their knowledge around how to stay safe online, what to watch for, things to avoid, things that are obvious, like scams. That is an ongoing need that individuals and organizations like CIRA need to pay attention to.
Yeah. Do you have any questions for us? Any additional thoughts or anything that you want to pose to the listeners?
My only comment was, one of the uses of the internet performance test, which is probably really underutilized, is its inclusion in research. And so it's really just an offer. And I think I've made this to Joel before, that if there's data that you're interested in, be really happy to offer that up. One of the important parts of it is, because it's a crowdsourced mechanism, is that getting the word out is really important to make sure that the data is up to date and reflective of the current situation, as reflective as that is possible. So yeah, really happy to have this conversation. And again, just my offer going forward, if there's anything that we can do to help you with your data collection, you know, just reach out.
Everybody should take a test.
Yes.
No matter where you are, you should take an internet performance test.
performance.cira.ca.
I think the same as what Jeff said, making sure that the word gets out around our NetGood Grants program far and wide, you know, all corners of across the country.
Thank you for listening. Please join us on our next episode. If you're enjoying the series, we hope that you'll support us by liking, subscribing, and sharing this podcast. Check out the show notes and project website for more information. We recognize that technology changes rapidly, and we acknowledge that these episodes were recorded over the past year. Some of the details may have changed since. Information and statements made were accurate at the time of recording.